Pulp Arcana, the Vintage Pulp Paperback Morgue.
The satyr. No woman could resist his hypnotic eyes. No woman could survive his sexual ritual. And so again and again, he searched for a woman. Any woman. Every woman. Satyr by Linda Crockett Gray. Published in 1981 by Playboy Paperbacks. So my physical copy of Satyr was released by Playboy Paperbacks, PEI Books, Inc., July 1981, 38 years ago this month. On the spine, the genre is listed as occult. I paid about $9, I think $9 to $12, somewhere in that range, online. For it a few years ago, probably 2017. It's a beautiful cover, kind of unique. I'll describe it in detail now. So it's about 90% sheer black. We have the door cracked open, the bright outside world. Not much detail is given of the light. But it's our satyr, it's our main villain, dragging in forcibly this clearly distressed woman who's frantic, tits firmly on display, plunging neckline, part of her clothes are coming down. The satyr himself, he's pulling her into the pure darkness where he's starting to fade. You can't really see much of his facial features. If I were to describe it, it looks like one of those Jesus oil paintings that your Catholic grandma has hanging up around her house. And it leads to, so the upper part is humanoid. He has a beard. He's leaning in there, dragging her by the arm. Leading down, you could see clearly his hoof. He's got cloven hoofs. The trademark of a satyr's lower animalistic body, hirsute torso, pretty much described. I don't think the scene specifically in here, because he wasn't that agile, our satyr in this book. He was more of a, his powers were more hypnotism, so he would stun his women. He wouldn't really forcibly, like, have to kidnap them and drag them off to anywhere. He was able to stun or stupefy them, per se, into petrification. And what other things here? So she has a red skirt, white blouse, clearly not consenting to this. She's horrified, clearly resisting. Our satyr has no clothes himself. When in the book, he dresses up as a human and tries to blend into society as best he could during the day. So the retail on this book was, I'll let you guess, it was the early 80s, 1981. Retail cover price on this, $2.50. That was about customary for the area, because I was checking out an Avon book from 1980. It was also $2.50 retail. I think that was Oktoberfest, a paperback. I was taking a picture for the Instagram account, Paul Parkonum. Let's open the pages here. So, if I were to describe Playboy paperbacks, they were kind of like a last breath revival of contemporary gothic romance. They published many women and female slanted stories. I think it was kind of like their dark fiction counter to their magazine, where they gave women a voice so they didn't appear as misogynistic, maybe. Because they're heavily female biased. Let's see here. I'm opening up the first page excerpt of about 3 paragraphs of the book. Second page, it says, "We hope you enjoy this book. If you like a free list of other books available from Playboy Paperbacks, just send your request to Playboy Paperbacks Book Mailing Service, P.O. Box 690, Rockville Center, New York, 11571. And then we have our title here, Sater Linda Crockett Gray, Playboy Paperbacks. Their logo is similar to a fleur-de-lis, I'd say. The other coloration on the cover, just to close out the cover, would be black. The letters are written in white. The title's written in white. And the other colors would be mostly brown. She dedicates it for her first front critics, Amy Sefton, Molly Gleason, Linda Barron, Ann Gentry, and Gray. And then we have all our copyright information pertaining to Linda Crockett Gray. The cover illustration copyright is protected by PEI Books, Inc. No artist given. She did another book released by Playboy called Siren. Very, very similar type of cover. So it's must be a house artist for Playboy. And we get an occultic symbol on the next page. It says, "Half a beast is the great god Pan." Then we have a quote from Elizabeth Barrett Browning that I'm not going to read. And it jumps into our story. So that is my elucidation of the Sater book released by Playboy Paperbacks. That's it for this segment. For this episode, our 5 factoid segment will be featured on our central character, the Satyr. Now, as with many English words, there's several enunciations that are proper and that could be used with Satyr. You could either say Satyr or Satyr. So there's that. The etymology traces back, obviously, from ancient times, because we're dealing with a classic mythological character here. So it traverses all the way back to Greek, where it's Satyrus, moved on to crossed over, melded with Latin, which was similar, Satyrus, that is Satyrus, and crossed over into Middle English as Satir. And that comes from the Webster's New World Dictionary in the late 80s. So I thought I'd read the definition of satyr. One of a class of lustful, drunken, woodland gods. In Greek art, they were represented as a man with a horse's ear and tail, but in Roman representations as a man with a goat's ears, tail, legs, and horns. So, he was essentially just a drunken fornicator, a practical prankster, the drunk friend of the god Bacchus of wine and fertility, and
let's read verbatim now the Wikipedia of the opening paragraph of satyr. So in Greek mythology, a satyr, also known as Silenos, is a male nature spirit with ears and a tail resembling those of a horse, as well as a permanent exaggerated erection. Early artistic representations sometimes include horse-like legs, but by 6th century BC, they were often represented with human legs. Comically hideous, they have mane-like hair, bestial faces, and snub noses, and are always shown naked. Satyrs were characterized by their ribaldry and were known as lovers of wine, music, dancing, and women. They were companions of the god Dionysus and were believed to... That was the Greek equivalent to Bacchus. Bacchus is the Roman mythology version of Dionysus, the god of wine and fertility, who were, back to this verbatim reading, were believed to inhabit remote locales such as woodlands, mountains, and pastures. They often attempted to seduce or rape the nymphs and mortal women alike, usually with little success. They are sometimes shown masturbating or engaging in bestiality. And that was the opening segment for the Wikipedia. Of note, in popular culture, actually throughout classical art, as they aged throughout the years and were known and adapted to different cultures, satyrs with their loathsome, lusty comportment were depicted in art as typifying the aggressive, beastly nature of man's sexuality. Therefore, usually a libertine man, a synonym for satyr, is known as a promiscuous and excessively libidinous man. So, the great bard himself, William Shakespeare, actually once dropped satyr, as he did with many mythological characters. Man was a genius. He actually used it in his greatest play and his greatest character, Hamlet, which will be read now. This, just an overview, this is in the beginning of the play, more so, towards when Hamlet is still depressed over the death of his father and the usurpation of his uncle taking over the throne as the king of Denmark, and him being the classic emo that he is, he's in a melancholic, suicidal thoughts and dwelling on his state and how he has no will. So, Hamlet. Oh, that this too sullied flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew, or that the everlasting had not fixed his cannon against self-slaughter. Oh, God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this, but 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king was this Hyperion to a satyr. And this is in direct comparison. He's comparing the Greek, one of the great classic Greek Titan gods, Hyperion, obviously almighty and his eminence, that being of his father, to the unscrupulous misdeeds of his uncle Claudius, that being of the satyr, who obviously with lascivious desires and intention propelled him to kill and murder his father to take over the throne. So I always love that line. It's one of the more memorable Shakespeare and Hamlet lines, and whenever I think of satyrs, I always think of that one. So that concludes the 5 factoid segment on satyrs. Hopefully it gives you a good overview of the character now. They were just basically drunken buffoons that went to parties and engaged in different clownery and foolish behavior. So that is what we're in for here. And coming up next will be the Skull Session review of Satyr.
A closer look at the author, Linda Crockett Gray. According to her official Wikipedia, it's just Linda Crockett. There isn't much story, and she doesn't give much interviews that I could really dig up online. So, but she does have her own Wikipedia page. She was born in 1943 in Hamilton, Ontario. So she, and that was in July, so she just turned 76 years old. I don't know when this was last updated, and I don't see many sources, and there really isn't, like I said, much external websites where you could go to and find out more information on her. But she had a little mini career that spanned over about a dozen years, starting in the late 70s, early 80s. She wrote primarily in the horror genre, thriller, and several Harley Quinn romances. She wrote for Playboy, Onyx, and Tor. And the Harley Quinn romances came in the mid-80s, including titles To Touch a Dream and A Moment of Magic and Song of the Seabird. And on her Wikipedia page, there is a part where they mark a historic moment of making the leading man disabled, and it was the first leading man that was disabled in this Harley Quinn romance. I don't know which title that is, of which chummy title that was, of what character or book that pertains to. But knowing Linda Crockett, yeah, she would make it man-hating. She would disable another male character. We'll get into that throughout the review. I'm going to keep this more informative and objective for the author profile. So, it also says she's a teacher of critical thinking in St. Petersburg, Florida, a high school teacher. And the direct definition of critical thinking is the objective analysis and evaluation of an issue in order to form a judgment. Straightforward as what you is what you would deduce that the it would be, but it's a good thing that Satyr is fiction, because there's no objectivity in that whatsoever. The author's bias seems to bleed through like a horrible grease stain. Now, apparently in the early 90s, she suffered an acute car accident that left her disabled, that severely hampered her writing career. I don't know anything about this story or the validity of it, or how graphic it was, or where the source even really comes from, but there's people that may know and may inform me, but so she didn't much publish any books after that, and her career is seized since then. So she's a 76-year-old woman. I don't know if she teaches, and she, once the mid-90s came, and she doesn't have much to her name, and if she decided to stick with teaching. But that is our author, Linda Crockett. Also of mentioning, I have to note a few more of her books, including outside of Satyr, she had Siren, as I previously mentioned in this podcast. That was given also a re-release cover, including a Playboy one. And then there's Scryer, another nice cover. Tangerine and Sandman. This book cover Now, I've run into this, but I passed on it because I cannot stand Linda Crockett Gray's atrocious prose. So, despite its glorious cover, I passed on it. This is the one where it's similar to the early 80s slasher, 1983 Alone in the Dark with Donald Pleasance and Jack Palance. It's similar to that, where it's like that intimidating killer coming out of the dark, holding, clutching a tool slash weapon, used as a weapon. In that case, in the movie, it's an axe. In this book cover, Sandman, it's a Tuck Point Trowel. And it's pointier than usual, but a great cover, but had to pass. Sorry, couldn't much stand or support anything, any type of detritus that this woman has put out. Anyway, was that enough stricture? Yeah, that was definitely enough criticism. That's my critical thinking on our author profile, Linda Crockett.
For this episode, the Skull Session is just going to be me going solo. It's JBM from villainnews.com. It's a rather obscure book. I couldn't really find too many people that had it or were willing to talk about satyrs. So, and it's kind of a controversial topic throughout, and I just felt like it would be more suitable to do it solo. So, to define and categorize what genre it would be in, I'd say it's firmly in the mythological creature horror, same way as a Grant Masterson type of book, or John Ferris did one called Minotaur, I believe, in the late 80s, early 90s for Tor, if I'm not mistaken. And it's separate from the cryptid horror, such as the Yetis or the Bigfoots or the Loch Ness. And so let's move on here to the other topic. So it was released by Playboy. I know I talked a little bit about other Playboy paperbacks that were released in the 70s and 80s. This is the paperback division, not the magazine. Okay, so these were actual horror paperbacks. And they weren't just limited. A lot of them were female writers, but they weren't just limited to that. I didn't expand on it earlier, so I can talk more about it now. I'm going to go through some of the images of what they released. I'm trying to collect them all. From what I see, there's at least 36 that are particularly horror. They did fantasy and some murder mystery, but they're all genre pieces. Let's see here. Obviously, Sater. Another author here I see, Jacqueline Martin. She did 2, at least that I know of, that I own both of them. This one's Nightmare in Red. It features a shrieking woman. And it's kind of like an actual model instead of a painting portrait. Okay, so Strange Seed. This cover was featured on Paperbacks from Hell. This is the one where it's like the nude boy like coming out of like the ivory swamp with like it draped around him like a toga. Gorgeous. The Beasts of Hades, The Emperor Princess. Okay, I have one of these books. This is a fantasy, but I'm not going to talk about it since we're going to stick to the horror ones. Here's another one from Russ Martin. I think he did a few, too, for Playboy that were published by Playboy paperbacks. This one's Rhea. It's actually similar to the Nightmare in Red cover. It features this chick in like a red nightgown holding a book. That one's more of an illustration. I know J.N. Williamson did a few Playboy press paperbacks too, including, I think Horror House was one of them. A lot of people compare that one to a YA horror. I really like that one. Don't have it. but I have The Banishing, which I believe came out in the late 70s, early 80s. It's a gorgeous cover. Moving on. Here's one that I just learned about recently. Too Much Horror Fiction shared this on his Facebook page. The Megalodon. It's actually just Megalodon. And by Robin Brown. I know a copy is out there for like $14. There's only one available on eBay when I checked. Hold on here. This webpage got torn away from it. Stick with me. All right. There's also one called The Accursed, and it's like Cerebus, the three-headed dog that guards the gates of hell. Here's another one that I don't own, Hellstone by Steve Spruill. And it's basically like this type of rock with iconography etched into it. And like this goblin type creature coming up and hoisting it out of the depths of darkness. Let's see here. Looks like they also released Ray Russell's Sagittarius. Forgot about that. That was them. Several anthologies. Space through here. A lot of romance too, I see. Okay, back to the book in hand. We're done with Playboy paperbacks. So, this book, the setting is hot and humid Tampa Bay, Florida. It's summertime, I believe. And our central character is Martha Boozer. She's a supervisor for the Rape Crisis Center through the Tampa Bay Police or something. I don't know if it's particularly the police department. But this book just reads as a mind comp for feminists. It's very unpleasant, appalling, and offensive to all mankind. Every review you see on it just gets poor reviews because she just trashes. It's almost like extremist feminine views that she expresses in this through her character, where it's like extremist behind the mask of fiction. It's a grotesque parable of man's lechery. She really demonizes and monsterizes men as these repulsive creatures of just basically pure rapists. We'll get into that. Her prose is extremely bland as it is. She has a tendency to summarize. This is only like one of those thin 200-page books. I think it's 180 pages. She summarizes the action scenes and occurrences right when it's amping up, right when it's leading up. You're like, okay, this satyr's stalking this woman. He's about to rape her. He's about to kill her. Here comes the violent horror scene that the audience wants. And boom, he hypnotizes her. It's a blur. It cuts to the next day. It really focuses more on the victimization when the reader is hankering for a deeper expression and details in action. You could tell that Linda Crockett Gray, she loathed the details and just kept drifting to what she liked about the story, which is the emotional victimization of the females and condemning these men and the patriarchy as beastly savages. And it's like they're the ultimate oppressor of women. And it's not even like me taking the underlining of this. Everyone's review features this. It's not even like subtle or insinuations. It's as blunt as like a cudgel coming at you. It's a full-on advocacy for feminism. And the opening scene is what I'll get into now.
Well, there's probably a few more things to get into. You could tell like she comes from the era of
second wave feminism where they were fighting for equal pay and more rights for women when they were actually more fighting for rights. But she takes it to an extremist point of view. And a lot of these feminists from this era ended up as professors and teachers in a lot of American universities that led to this boom of the absurdities of modern day feminism, where you hear terms of abuse like the mansplaining or manspreading or attacks on men because they've oppressed women for so long, or brainwashing men into hating themselves, and it's really sad. It's really social media that was the steroid that ballooned it into this preposterous region. So, I mean, you all have seen the memes. Just type in a YouTube video about feminists going off and you'll get a great example of that. So this is what you get when you read this. No one recommends it. Women and men have got criticism for it, the few that have actually read the book. So the satyr creature he's from the mountainous region in Turkey. He basically was expelled by his own kind. He comes from a region where they are deep in the mountains and they've gone into seclusion where, because they've been shunned by civilization for their luxury over the years. And he was more of a renegade. Porno wouldn't gratify him. I mean, but he comes from the mountains in the 70s. It's like there was no internet to keep him like a variety there. So he broke out. He's on the loose. He came to the USA. Actually, she even says that he was tainted by US soldiers in Turkey, where he learned terms and phrases like piece of ass. And you're like, give me a break. So she still blames it on white Western men. And so his powers are hypnosis by staring into your eyes and entrancing and seducing them. He also invades their dreams by terrorizing them in there. He has these fiery red eyes, a bare torso, actual goat legs as just in the cover, and he functions in society like the satyr race still exists, but he wears a long type of trench coat to hide his deformity of the bent legs. Well, everyone thinks he's disabled because of the way he walks, but obviously it's the legs of a goat. So I'm going to go to my notes of the opening of the book. Part one, full force. Get ready for this. She's speaking, Martha Boozer, our lead character, supervisor of the Rape Crisis Center. Like I said, she's speaking at an assembly, more like pontificating, where she's like, if you've ever laid, screwed, coerced, maneuvered in on a girl, then you're a rapist. And that's like a verbatim excerpt right there. And you're like, wow, like, should I continue? It's like this feminist cudgel, like, right, pummeled right into your head, right in the opening pages. It's it's like her indoctrination manifesto. And you're like, who's going to get any pleasure from this? And she continues where she's like, all you guys love to talk harshly or crudely about sexual conquest. And she's like, no, that's a typical rapist take on the process. He usually takes it further from that, but he's usually less subtle. So anyone that apparently talks about their conquest or sleeping with a woman is a rapist too, or it's the vernacular of a rapist. It's just so laughable. And this woman is projected as like the Wonder Woman of feminism. There is a rape culture out there and it's sad. And a lot of women, let me just say this before we dive into it, not to make light of it or anything, because there, we all know a lot of women who have been affected by sexual abuse, even domestically in the home and family wise. And it can scar them and ruin them for life. But there's also the insinuations that she made. No, they're basically blatant accusations that every man has this animalistic libido in him where he's violent, he's aggressive, he can't control his urges, and all men are rapists. That's how extreme it gets in this. That's why I say it's offensive and stuff. Okay, just to make that clear. So, moving on. So she returns back to her office. Apparently she has a whole wing. This is just such fantasy. And as soon as she gets back, there's already a young woman waiting for her. She actually does hands-on work. She doesn't just do all these like rape assemblies at different seminars and stuff. She actually does some investigative work where women come in to put forth their claims. So anyway, this young female named Queen, they describe her as dark brown skinned. She's like, oh, I was raped, and she's completely in distress. And straight up Martha's reaction is pure disbelief. She's like, oh, you mean you were taken advantage of? And this just puzzles the reader at this point, because then your main hero, who she said, like, oh, if you talk about coercion or screwing a girl or ever saying you got laid, then you're a rapist. And now this girl comes in saying a victim of rape, and she's like, oh, you mean you were taken advantage of? So, like, she's questioning when all females or like all activists this way, like, say never question, always believe a woman. At least that's the modern day take. Anyway, so this woman worked at a, he targets like women that work at diners and restaurants and stores and stuff who are coming home late at night. So I'm a total sleazeball who kind of hangs out in the alleyways and the parking lots and stalks his women, and he ends up hypnotizing them. And I think she describes it as a man with disabled legs offered her a ride home and she accepts. She ends up blacked out, pantless at home. So anyway, so she calls through the details of, she calls the details from her through hypnosis. And Martha has this deep philosophy that, like, she has these sexual fantasies from sexual repression. So she's just, like, totally, like, theorizing that this woman wasn't raped, even though, like, this isn't anything that the character would believe. It's just total contrary. So anyway, she also has this boyfriend slash husband. I think he's just a boyfriend who works at like the local college or something named Jed. And he likes to call like his fellow colleagues like a titless wonder. And he just makes all these like raunchy jokes. And it's just like, why would Martha even be with him either? It makes no sense. It's just like, he's just like set up for like one-liner punchlines for Martha. It's just like so crudely constructed. Like her prose is as crudely assembled as like Lincoln logs put together by a toddler. It's that bad and unenjoyable. And you know, raunchy jokes around Martha. Anyway, we meet Ahmad. He's cloaked. His condition in the trench coat, like I said, he ends up raping and screaming like the great god Pan, this at this waitress in a parking lot. So it's the repeated, you're going to notice this pattern. It's a repeat of stalk, rape victim shows up at Martha, and we get to the victimization process where basically Linda Crockett Gray just talks about her real life experience of dealing with this. I don't know if she worked at a rape crisis center or anything, but it appears she did, or this was her dream job or something, because she seems to have a lot of details about it. And it's just like it just feels like she's writing about herself. Is the impression you get. Don't know that, but anyway, so this waitress ends up finding a white mucoid substance in her panties, I have written down. We could all assume what that is. Anyway, the cops phone Martha. Queen ends up dead. It appears she drowns in the bathtub. I think a few die this, and they think it's accidental, but, you know, Martha's on the case. Anyway, so we get a new woman. I think she's Mexican. I think her name's Marina, and she's raped at knife point in detail. This is the one that's probably like the one of the few that's in detail. But the rapist didn't ejaculate to save face, so to speak, is what Martha said. I don't know what that tips off. Keep in mind, I read this over a month ago. I've read like 3 books since then, so I'm finally getting around to recording this. So some of the details have evanesced from my mind. So bear with me. Now we jump to page 41. Ahmad jizzes himself at a matinee theater showing. This is the old pornographic theaters and stuff. This is also a crusade against porno and porno theaters. Yes. This is a Playboy paperback where this writer is a character blaming porno on rape culture. So there's that. And, of course, Imod being the provocative satyr that he is going to these. And Martha's trying to advocate to get all these shut down. So it's starting to piss off Imod. He also goes down to the old porn magazine's adult bookstore. And the other waitress that we meet that he raped earlier in the book, Brenda, the Waffle House waitress, she ends up being found dead in the shower. Ahmad showed up naked and horny with a boner. And fast forward with like insinuations of rape and death. Because there isn't much detail into this one either. So, I mean, that's where you reap no enjoyment. It just keeps on going through the same stages, same repetitive stages. Anyway, so she could just spew out her stats on rape and how rape crisis centers work and how a rape kit works and the procedure and stuff like that. So the next victim of the Me Too Tampa Bay movement talks to Martha asking, is it still rape if you were drugged? And then, like, Brenda's like, it sure is. And I just, like, laughed my ass off because you could just, like, the gratification that Linda Crockett Gray got from writing this just oozes from that phrase right there. Anyway, moving on. Martha meets up with this Detective O'Neill. Remember, Martha has like no cachet, no weight at the whole in the police department. She's just a certain section where she does the rape kits and everything like that. But it says like she runs a staff of 20, which is pretty laughable because we know that isn't the case. I'm walking over to get my water. Bear with me, okay? Drink your own water. Take your own hits. Here we go. Time to Kevin Smith it up in this. Hold up. Okay, Martha ends up inferring that because all these women end up dead after they see her. Remember, in the shower and stuff. So Martha infers that these raped murder victims like died not by accident, but by the rapist beast who invaded their dreams. Because remember, she put these people under hypnosis where they were talking about, because they couldn't remember. That's part of Imad the Satyr's powers, is he's got this hypnotism to like completely black them out. It's like psionic roofies is what he does. And then they wake up and it's just their mind's blank, a haze. So leave it to Martha. She's got to infer that it's this. She sees men as beasts anyway. So she's like, hey, it's got to be this beast who's involved in their dreams. Now we learn about Ahmad's background. He's from Turkey. He was formerly in the Islam. And he was stalking girls on campus. It does some background. Anyway, he's at like the Tampa Bay University or something. And he starts stalking college chicks too. And it's clear at this point that Martha has her limitations. Like I said earlier, she can't perform a rape exam. She needs to pull favors to get any information investigation-wise because they're investigating the murders and she can't get the file on it, you know, because she's not a cop. She can't prescribe pills even though she's a doctor. So I don't get that either. And this bitch needs like 25-person brigade just to crusade against rape. She has no authority to do anything. It's like, what are these people even doing? She also runs this rape, like, hotline or something, and someone's got to be on it at all times, you know? And we're just entering chapter 3 here. That's how pathetic this is. So there's a conference to a room of women's group. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, she has another conference. We just follow her. This is like take your kid to work day. It's like if this was your mom, it would be, like, excruciating to the ears. And she's like, we are fostering a subculture of violence. And she's just excoriating all the pornographic theaters and bookstores that are breeding factories for rapists. It's such a disgraceful pillory on porno that it hasn't aged too well. Because she's like, because of these theaters and bookstores. It's like, I wonder what Linda Crockett Gray thinks about the internet porn, how that's exploded. Anyway, the jocularity is heightened for it being like Playboy Press, of course. And this whole crowd, you know what Martha ends up doing at this conference? She sells this slideshow. She actually subjects these women to like 20 minutes of torture porn where like children are getting raped and there's like a snuff film. To the point where they're like horrified and literally retching in their seats. She's just brainwashing them to be crusading feminists that complain to shut down theaters and bookstores. Through the newspapers, Ahmad catches wind of this manhunt for the murderer. He's most pissed about the crusade by Martha to shut down all these bookstores and theaters. So he chases Martha. So he targets Martha and he ends up like chasing her down the road on the highway and he runs her off the road and her car ends up in the ditch and Ahmad speeds away. This is still like only halfway through the book, so he isn't caught or anything. And it's not confirmed that like he's a satyr, but you know, Martha's in on it, so. Let's see here. Let's speed through this. There's still like so much to go here. So Ahmad's debauchery is where he smokes weed and he drinks a lot, of course, indicative of the actual mythological satyr who is known as a partier. He reflects on his upbringing as a Muslim in Turkey and his sybaritic ways of destructive lust. Like his grandfather. So Linda Crockett Gray, she's like such a super scornful of Islam and heightens their oppressive shelling of women. And it's so funny because this is like the only thing that's super contrary to how feminists think nowadays. Because the feminist side of the political party falls on the left side and they're more secular. So their biggest enemy is Christianity, so they like to go after Christians. But Christians love to go after Muslims and Islam. So the left is put in a position to defend Muslims and Islam. And even though they're known as being super oppressive to women with the hijab and not letting them go out in public and totally violating their human rights, but they can't be scorned against because that's just the political arena that we live in nowadays. And the only reason why I'm bringing this up is because it pertains to this, of how there's a lot of Islamophobia from Linda Crockett Gray in this. Guarantee she doesn't feel this way nowadays. But he was really this is where she adds where how he was really corrupted by the U.S. soldiers in Turkey at the base, who taught him like raunchy phrases like piece of ass, like I said. And as if this book hasn't been torturous enough, there's just tedious details into this rape exam, and it's just an anatomical breakdown of it. And I'm going to finish the second half of this review on the flip side of this, so tune in. Welcome back to the second part of the review. So let's do a little recap. Women are dying after a few days after they get raped. So they rape, he rapes them. They don't die. They end up found dead. And that leaves holes in there for a theory to be formulated by our freaking Wonder Woman hero, Martha Boozer. As if her last name isn't laughable enough, her ideology is even more pathetic. Here we go. Oh yeah, the details are crap because we don't get to hear about anything. So you're left with this hunger for gore, and it's happening all around, or at least it's being alluded to, but nothing's freaking happening. Anyway, so Imad, our satyr, he's from Turkey. This is where they get back into a little bit of his background. So let's jump in here. So these wise men in Turkey convene to discuss the renegade satyr rapings that they hear about in the U.S. through the news. I don't freaking remember. Anyway, satyrs were, over time, repressed and shunned by the religious man, civilized world. And we're talking B.C. era here. So anyway, they were only welcomed into the sanctuary of the mountainous grottos of the shepherd regions of Turkey. Their old mentor in the scene proclaims that culpability in Ahmad's reprehensibility, and the porn can't keep him gratified, is what they keep repeating. So that's their conclusion. Anyway, so it jumps back to Tampa Bay, to our main character. The DNA from the rape exam comes back from one of the women, and it comes back as semen, animal semen, to invoke Anthony Anderson in White Castle, 2004, great stoner comedy. Anyway, they're goat pubes embedded in the semen is what I wrote down. So I guess that happens. Anyway, so we learn from a professor through Martha's boyfriend. Remember, he works at a college, I believe. So all his colleagues are teachers. So that she has a direct hookup to an archaeological professor. And we learn that the top half of the satyr is known for intelligence, man, and the bottom half is the sexual nature of animal, horse, goat-like. Remember, they don't know that it's a satyr yet, but obviously this throws even more complexity to the mystery of rapes going on in Tampa that are rampant. Anyway, this is like, well, remember how I said Martha Boozer is like Wonder Woman? This is like Flash Gordon taking on his Ming, or Luke Skywalker taking on his Vader. And she has a satyr in her backyard that she gets to take on. Yet she likes to still get drunk with her boyfriend and go to these rape seminars and advocate against pornos if that's like breeding rape culture. Yet she's got Darth Vader in her backyard. She's got the most lecherous rapist of all time, just raping and killing women in her backyard. Anyway, I digress. Not really, though, because it really pertains to how pitiful she is. So we go back to our cavernous meeting among the ancient satyrs, and Ahmad's grandpa declares he'll hunt down Ahmad in America for the horrors that he committed. So fast forward, because they really sum up everything. He's already in the U.S. like the next paragraph, and he spots a mosque at the University of Tampa. And Ahmad's getting drunk, and he's, like, flexing his hairy pube torso while watching the news of the murders. I write down that there's a particular excerpt of how incensed this book makes me on page 128, paragraph 3. But to save you from it and keep things speeding, because I still have, like, 3 pages of notes here, I'm going to keep on going. Because this is going to be like a 2-hour podcast if I get into every detail. And it's really not even worth that close an examination of the minutia. So, moving on. Martha gives another vexing seminar to a packed hall of zealous women. And goes on about like the procedures and spewing out statistics of 1 in 10 report a rape. And in Atlanta, there's a rape crisis unit that has a volunteer staff working 12-hour shifts and rotating all through. And she's going through all this technical detail of, like, this hubbub of rape centers in Atlanta or something. Like, you could tell, like, she, like, this is, like, an enterprise of envy for her. So that's why she goes on to this useless detail. And you're like, give me a break, lady. And she, anyway. So Martha ends up meeting with this wiser, older professor that I mentioned earlier. It's an anthropologist professor. We get there's so many, like many mythological and pagan religions, it's so vague and interweaved and incomplete that you could formulate any type of history of the satyr and its origins, and really it's an amalgam, so you really can't go wrong in postulating the origins and the history of the satyr. Like, I could have, like, in my opening, how I read and gave you a lot of facts of the satyr, I could go on for hours upon hours doing a podcast just on the satyr creature as it is. Anyway, the angle that she takes is in the 4th millennium. She takes it all the way back to us ancient Sumerian days and the king of Gilgamesh versus Eknandu. And the first tale of that was the first tale of a half man, half beast legend region in north of Persia, which is modern day Iran and Iraq now. And the meeting took place for 2 hours. She gave no insight on the case. And he would have been curious to know. Hold up. Oh, yeah, yeah. This is my notes on it. So she's meeting with this guy, this professor, for 2 hours. And she gives no insight on the rapes or what's going on or how they found goat semen and stuff like that. Or if there could be a satyr that, you know, survived existence like the cryptid Bigfoot. So she shouldn't be alone with a woman who thinks every man is a rapist, is like the... Oh, yeah, yeah. He shouldn't be alone with a woman who thinks every man is a rapist, is what I wrote down, which is true. Like, does he know this woman's history? I would not be alone with her. Anyway. So, moving on, page 154. Ahmad directly invades this rape center to confront Martha. Oh, yeah, this shit's hilarious. He goes full on Pan, and he learns that she's not there, and he finds a sketched image of a satyr on her desk, so he knows that she's onto her, and he infers a woman sketched this image as an image of her dreams, because he knows this is, like, the horrifying imagery that he puts in women's dreams of, and obviously nightmares. I shouldn't say dreams. If you're going to say it's a horrific night, a dream, it's basically, there's another word for that. Nightmare. Okay, great. Because I'm all about semantics here. So he's paranoid about this discovery. So he lets out this whole growl a la Pan. This is where the word panic comes from. The scream of the ancient god Pan. And they conflate the lineage of Pan and satyrs here a lot in this book, as is the creature is in real life history. And the fire alarm goes off, the building is evacuated, and it makes the news. And simultaneously, this body of this girl is found underneath the bridge in the water. I don't know why. Now I'm starting to make this like connection that they all end up like in water or the shower. I don't know why that is. I don't think it's particularly explained from what I remember. So Martha Boozer, since he came after her this time and he was asking for her, Ahmad gets away. I don't remember how he gets away, but I didn't write. He definitely, because this is still like about 70% through the book. So Ahmad's after Martha. It's clear by now. And Martha ends up getting this police escort to clear her house before she enters because she's a total pussy ass superhero in this, and this officer is calling her ma'am, and she gets offended by that, and she likes to call like she's like no, just call me Martha or Miss Boozer if you want to hear from me ever again or something like that. She uses it as a moment to like correct his manners, and like this is how absurd this is. Like, this is like the seeds of how absurd feminine, because you know how some feminists get offended by men holding open the door nowadays? Yeah, well, you can see where the seeds of this come from when Martha is getting pissed about being called ma'am. Even though she's the one who's can't even defend herself and she's got police escorts, she should be thankful. It's just totally self-degrading for her in this character. You guys see it. Do I really have to elucidate it? I mean, she's just an utter bitch. This cop spends the night like wanting to watching like video cassettes, which is interesting because this was published in 1981, so this is like the early days of VHS. So Marshall's like, I'll whistle if I need you. I'm going to bed, you know. And anyway, we cut to Abdul Khaldan. I think this is, yeah, his grandpa, remember, who's going to go and retrieve Ahmad because he's running rampant on the streets of Tampa, like raping and killing women. Anyway, so they're trying to get him back and stop this because he's about to ruin it for all satyr kind. And anyway, so they show up and they're already like appear in Martha's bedroom and they're like, we're in a race that's been expected and despised. We're a race. Oh, it's, yeah, we're a race that's been expelled and despised. And now we're a myth and we're hunted and we can't be exposed. So help us catch her, Ahmad. And they explain that he's a satyr to her because she couldn't. She pretty much already fully put it together, but this is obviously when they convene and meet up and team up. So nature's our only god is what they explain, and we need you to intercede because our powers are equal to his, and thus we cannot prevail. Some bogus excuse like that just to make her the hero. So we move on. Next, Ahmad is prowling outside of Martha's house, urinating in like the geranium flowers, and Ahmad ends up raping another chick, and the prose is actually fantastic here. This happens in some books where sometimes the prose starts out really good. You could tell like the author started off with a good idea and paid attention to detail, then they get lazy and sloppy with the book as the book goes on. Or there's a reverse of that where they kind of hold back and then they kind of ramp it up slowly and gradually. So I will give some credit here. It starts to get pretty good and there's more detail in it finally, because the prose has been extremely bland to this point. Anyway, there's a lot of emotion and terror felt through, is what I wrote, and that's from what I remember, yeah. So I'm going to give its praise when it's due. Moving on, page 176, read the excerpt. Jed discovers Seder origins, not Brenda. Yeah, so it's Jed who's separate from Brenda. He figures out the Seder origins because Brenda didn't fully put it together. She had to get, you know, told it by the elders who came to retrieve him. Moving on. Next page. Sweet. Wait. Yeah, here we go. Martha is, like, guarded like the president at this point, and, I know I wrote the ending on two different pages, so hold up, bear with me. Oh, yeah, Martha's reaction is like, oh, he'll come to the house and the police will arrest me. They set her up as like a bait, like a decoy duck or something, and to draw him there. And the other's like, nope, he's smart. It won't work if you lure him to the lake outside behind your house, and then we could take him down because the cops can't. So they gift her a talisman and of precious geometric intricacy and regal value. It's supposed to keep her obviously safe from him. And the elder ends up telling Martha a sad sob story of how ancient satyrs were jesting social creatures who mingled among men, and over time they became pariahs, and now they want to be anonymous. And they're like, how do we curb their libido is what they ask her or something, or that's how they're trying to devolve themselves and live a more ascetic life. So Martha was able to lure him to the docks of the lake, is it what ends up happening in the next scene here. But this is entirely the ending, because the elders entrap him, but Ahmad is naked and afraid, like out in like the cattails of the swamps out there, and he loses his erection, and he's like shaking in his little hooves. Next thing you know, Ahmad like ceremoniously whips out his ancient sword and like announces he's been ordered for execution, and Ahmad ends up accepting his fatal penalty, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, and like gets disemboweled with the torso at the torso. Let me see if this is completely. Oh, okay. Before this happens, the morgue examination reveals the dead body under the bridge, bled to death due to a perforation of the uterine gland, the uterus wall, and there was no ejaculation. And the elders show back up at the lake. Okay, so this is what happens. We need you. Oh, yeah. They just tell her to hang out there as a decoy, like I said. So, yeah, that's how he takes them down. He ends up, I thought they were leading up to, like, I guess the twist is instead of, like, trying to talk him out of it or whatever and bring him back, he ends up whipping out this long sword and, like I said, disemboweling him. Let me catch back where my notes are. All right. I'm here, guys. Don't worry. JBM needs his liquids, too. So, O'Neill, this is the cop, remember. He's with the examining the body with the coroner, and it says legless and careless is what I wrote down. I don't know what that pertains to. Anyway, the chick bears a satyr baby in the hospital. One of the chicks that he rapes, I guess. So they all usually end up dead, but this chick ends up birthing the satyr. I barely even remember this. Wow. Oh, okay. So, it's a very unheroic of her. She's just the... They just basically turn her into, like, the damsel in distress, like... Hey, like, he'll smell your femininity and come out to the lake, and we'll handle him from there. You take your little precious talisman as, like, a safety net, and don't worry. We got him. So she's not heroic at all. I see no bravery. Not from her, at least, our superwoman. Anyway, our conclusion, the epilogue, essentially. We finally have Martha giving... You know what happens. She's got to give one more lecture. And it's super important to these high school students, of course. And the inner thoughts are like, it's summer between now and next fall. Someone will be raped. And some will be raped. No, some of you will be... Oh, yeah. These are high school students graduating. And, like, the public schools have to be subjected to this shit where she's like, it's summer now. Between now and next fall, some of you will be rapists and some of you will be raped. And you're like, what the fuck? She's just such a woman, a man-hating, like, feminazi. It's so pathetic. And you see it as, like, you wish, you know, Linda Crockett Gray, who's, like, apparently a teacher of critical thinking. I doubt that she's overt. As Martha Boozer, this is probably what she aspires to be in her true life and hold these convictions, which is pretty sad because as a male and female, I could objectively say, I'm not claiming to be a male or female. Let me phrase it this way. Objectively, I could say that women have their advantages and disadvantages in society. Same way as men have their advantages and disadvantages in society. Does it balance out in the end? You could say that because in different areas, you could always argue it's never going to be equal. And we don't have to get into specific areas, but that's just how it is. And anyway, and there's nothing controversial about saying that because we all have our strengths. Each sex does. That the other sex is envious of. So that's just, there's always just going to be biological and societal differences between the two sexes. But we mature and we civilize as a society. Anyway, so final line. It's like she just goes on to just blast men in these final few paragraphs. And then the verbatim final line of the book is, she was on a roll. You're like, laugh my fucking ass off. She was on a roll. Denigrating mankind. Calling them all rapists to a bunch of 17 and 18-year-old boys in the crowd. She should feel so proud of herself. So, that was the conclusion of Seder, 1981. And I'd like to say now that if you're a reader of any pulp, horror, dark fantasy from the 1920s all the way up into the early to mid-90s and want to read a book and have a suggestion or want to join and talk about your collection, just reach out to me. I'm on Facebook. The page is Pulp Arcanum. I'm in several horror book groups. I already have a number of different friends that plan on coming on. And the next review that I plan on doing is actually Water Baby from 1987, I believe, Patricia Wallace. That's a zebra cover. It's a classic one. It's the mythological creature, a mermaid. It's the one where it's like the skeleton mermaid with a baby. It's a nice aquatic setting for summer here. So that'll be the next one coming out. And thank you for listening. And yeah, just message me directly. I would love to have you join so we could talk horror books.
Now is our bonus reading segment. Originally published in May 1963 from Bantam Books, it's Rod Serling's Triple W, Witches, Warlocks, and Werewolves. It's an anthology that he handpicked these stories. There's about 10 here, roughly ranging from the 1950s to the early 1960s. Anyway, so obviously, since it was his anthology, he wrote the intro to it, so I thought I'd do a little bonus reading and read his intro, so bear with me. This is all going to be one take, straight reading from the letters of Rod Serling. Here we go. Introduction by Rod Serling. I am unabashedly and admittedly admirer of horror tales. If this makes me psychiatrically suspect, my guess is that I share an almost universal affliction. Of all human responses to stimuli, there is probably none quite so commonplace and so difficult to admit as the very human fascination for the weird, the grotesque, even the horrible. Assuredly, it must be this fascination that grips the 10-year-old child watching a spooky movie, forces him to plaster small hands across eyes at particularly horrendous moments, but then pries two fingers apart for a quick peek at the very thing that frightens him most. Our responses to this kind of fright motive seem to undergo a metamorphosis as we take on years. The child is afraid of the shadowy attic and the gloomy cellar. He is wary of the dark corner and the closed closet. His is the formless fear of the unknown, the unexpected, the indistinct wraith that waits to pounce. Maturity seems to give form to fear. The most sophisticated adult will still pucker up and whistle unmelodiously during a midnight walk past a cemetery, or will, when alone in a large house, listen to the creak of some distant and invisible door, the whistle of an errant wind, the unbidden bang of a far-off shutter, and will then, though again never admittedly, let a secret portion of his mind paint a picture of what and who is the intruder. And quite beyond the always possible omniscient burglar is the night visitor that we deny. Our rational senses reject, our trained minds eliminate, our whole society would scoff at. Vampires? Only Bram Stoker's literary figures. Witches and werewolves? Legendary shadows that have no existence. Ghouls and the Walking Dead? Cool it, Jack. There are the 1960s. The real invisible horrors are sufficiently with us. Like strong thium 90 and fallout of radioactivity. Let these form your neurosis. Why dig into fantasy and mythology? Why indeed? Because most probably, man's scientific horrors are so totally destructive as to make them unimaginative. They're also transcendent of man's own will. Global Frankensteins forever threatening to escape their creators. Now contrast them to the age-old horrors, the denizens of the night that are ancient as the human race, the witches, the warlocks, the sorcerers, and the other nocturnal people. So personal and so personalized, so capable of wreaking evil on you. One doesn't shudder at the idea of hydrogen holocaust. One shrugs. It is too massive and formed to become an element of reality and nightmares. But the saber-toothed Dracula who comes alone to your door, the witch who concocts the bitter brew for you and you alone, the stalking thing from the grave that heads for your doorstep, not the world's, these are creatures of your own creation. One can share the manifestations of an audience's reaction, the collective shudders, the chorus of gas, even the mass silence of bated breaths. But each man's fear is his alone. It's your private domain. It relates only to you and to you it. So this is by way of introduction to the stories you're going to read in this book. These stories are varied, representative, and some of the most imaginative of the ilk. They all deal with those beings who from time immemorial have attempted to control supernatural forces, and have often that the demon invoked controlled them. Read these stories one at a time with a few hours space between. Try reading them at night or on a gray and somber day, and be sure to read them alone. If the effects are not immediate and pronounced, don't worry. If the palms don't perspire or the neck bristle, this doesn't make you any less sensitive than most. It's cumulative results that count. The next time your wife asks you to go down to the basement to get a jar of preserves, and while you're down there, a fuse blows and you're standing in darkness, looking in the black void where once there was a familiar place, and you see... ... Enjoy yourselves. From the legendary Rod Serling, wrote that introduction from 1963. Rod Serling's Triple W, Witches, Warlocks, and Werewolves, from Bantam Books. This was a bonus reading segment from JBM Pulp Arcanum. Pulp Arcanum is a podcast featuring content and discussions on the pulp fiction genres of 20th century literature, horror, adventure, fantasy, and sci-fi. The fantastical stories published in the 1920s pulp magazines ignited the era with an explosion of strange and weird tales. To participate in upcoming skull sessions on the podcast, email me directly at pulparcanum@gmail.com. That's pulparcanum. For Facebook, there's a page, Pulp Arcanum Podcast. Also, many paperback collection photos are featured on the Instagram.